Welcome to the world of Laputa. Come celebrate the 35th birthday with us because your geek history lesson on Castle in the Sky is now in session. Hello and welcome to Geek History Lesson. I am Ashley Victoria Robinson.
And I am Jason Patsu Inman. Welcome to your Mind University, because that is what we like to call this podcast, Geek History Lesson, that you are listening to, because we are a Mind University that teaches you about one character, one construct, or even one movie in a little bit less than an hour, and make you feel all nice inside, make you feel like you can fly up to a castle in the sky, which is the name of the movie that we're talking about today.
Hey.
Ashley, why are we talking about Castle in the Sky?
Well, like I mentioned in our intro, it is the 35th anniversary of Castle in the Sky. This is one of the Studio Ghibli Hayao Miyazaki movies that I have never seen. Mm-hmm. All the previous ones, no, that's a lie, because I also had not seen Howl's Moving Castle. Oh, most of the previous ones
we've done. You heard it here, Ashley Victoria Robinson, liar. No.
Don't give Twitter any more fuel.
That's
please.
Fair. I will retract that statement.
I had never seen it. You had never seen it. So this seemed like the perfect opportunity.
Yes, and we have been doing a lot of Studio Ghibli films on this podcast for the last couple of years, and we've been having a lot of fun. And speaking of having a lot of fun, we have a very special guest for today, don't we?
Yes, a special guest who we've been trying to bring on for a long, long time. So I'm glad that we finally get to have her today. We have the host of the Geek and Glitter podcast, the Movie Couple YouTube channel, and Hollywood Critics Association member, very fancy, Wendy Lee Zaney is joining us today. Hi, Wendy.
Hello. Thank you so much for that incredible intro.
Thank you. It's your Twitter bio, so you did the heavy lifting on it.
Oh, thanks. I didn't even realize that I wrote that about myself.
Wendy,
professional writer Wendy.
Yeah, your bona fides. I'm sorry that you had to like lower yourself to come on our podcast.
I mean, oh my gosh, stop.
Also, actually, she's had me on twice, so we definitely owe Wendy.
I'm so excited that I'm on here because I do listen to the podcast and I'm like slightly geeked out. Like when I got the email, I was like, wait, and it's funny because like we're friends. So it's not like, you know, this is like a cold email that you guys did, but I was like, wait, I get to be on their podcast. Score.
Nice. Nice. Now, Wendy, if you don't mind me asking, what is your just general relationship with Studio Ghibli films? I mean, do you enjoy most of them? You know, do you have a favorite? I just would love to hear some background on that.
I actually grew up with Studio Ghibli films. My grandfather spoke Japanese. So here's a little like personal history. Both my grandparents on both sides, they grew up in Taiwan during when Japan had, I don't want to like say overtook Taiwan, but they had, you know, they had a big presence in our country. So all four of my grandparents grew up speaking Japanese as their main language because they were learning that in school instead of Mandarin. My grandfather actually didn't start speaking Mandarin until I think like first year in college when him and my grandmother met.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Which is, it is fascinating. And they would communicate to each other in Japanese. And I'm like, what is this? Apparently I spoke it when I was a child. I don't remember that. My Japanese
really?
Is very, very basic.
Wow.
You gotta get on that Duolingo game.
Yeah.
I have it. It helped a lot when I, right before we went to Tokyo, I was like cramming every night. I was like, all right.
Did you find yourself, you were able to like pick it up easily? Or was it still just like, I don't remember this?
I was surprised that there were certain phrases that I actually remembered out of nowhere. Like I needed water. We were at Disneyland and I needed water. And all of a sudden the word water came to mind without me looking it up. I'm like, how do I know this? And just like calling somebody over and saying like, oh, I'm sorry. And they're like, oh, and then they started speaking. I'm like, oh, no, wait, no, you've lost me. I don't know what you just said.
Well, another thing, I'm sorry, Wendy, go ahead.
No, I surprised myself. Oh. I was like, oh, I think I can survive here. Okay.
Well, I was going to throw out another bona fide that I know you have, Wendy, because there is a very funny story where Ashley and I once made the journey to San Francisco to a, I don't remember the name of the store, but there was a Studio Ghibli.
It was Her Universe.
It was Her Universe Studio Ghibli like event because Ashley really wanted to go. And so we made the trip and we walk inside and you know, we don't live in San Francisco, and I know, Wendy, you do not either. And we walk inside, and there you are. You're at the event.
Small world. I was so happy to have ran into you guys there. And just, I think we walked to a little spot and grabbed food.
That cafe had a tree growing inside of it. And I will remember it until I pass away because it was so cool.
Yeah, it's really cool.
It's Lapita.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I know we all spent way too much money at that store event. Enough of this jibba jabber. The listeners are like, come on, talk about Castle in the Sky. So Ashley, why don't you kick us off?
Okay, so we are going to go into the Tencent origin, the first part of the podcast. We are covering Castle in the Sky. Happy 35th birthday. Fun fact, it was released the same year as The Great Mouse Detective, which is an episode that we did recently in our feed. It is a 1986 animated fantasy film. The release date was August 2nd, 1986, which is why we're releasing this episode this week. Produced by Studio Ghibli and distributed by Toei and Disney. Sometimes I get Toei and Toho confused in my brain. One of them makes Godzilla, one of them makes animation. It's currently streaming at the time of this recording on HBO Max. If you're listening to this in the future, figure out where it is. It was directed and written by Hayao Miyazaki. Now, longtime listeners of the pod know that original Miyazaki movies are a mixed bag for Jason. He likes the adaptation stories better. So we're going to see.
I do.
How that shakes out for today.
I just think he's a better adapter. Nothing to his.
No. It's just an opinion.
I also think he's a great writer, but I just think overall, like, his adaptations are stronger.
I will fight you on that until I pass away. The music is by Joe Hisaishi. I always like to shout out the music because Studio Ghibli uses a number of different composers over the course of their oeuvre, and the music, it always sounds like Studio Ghibli music, but it's always very different and very unique. So that's the composer that they used for this one.
My second note for our Castle in the Sky discussion is all caps, great music with 3 exclamation points.
There you go. The budget for this movie was $3.3 million approximately. I bring this up because by contrast, the last Ghibli movie we covered was Arrietty. The budget for Arrietty was $23 million.
Oh.
So big jump. Now there's also 30 years and there's 30 years of inflation.
Yes.
But you know, they can do a lot
of gambling.
Hayao Miyazaki, famous gambler.
Famous gambler.
And the box office gains were $15.5 million. So no wonder that they went on to be a very successful company and make more projects. It follows the adventure of a young boy and girl in the late 19th century attempting to keep a magical crystal from a group of military agents while searching for the legendary floating castle. Jason and I watched the English dub so that we could take notes and do analysis, and the English voice cast, which recorded in 1989, includes Mark Hamill, Cloris Leachman, Anna Paquin, and James Vanderbeek. One of those people I didn't think would be good and was very good.
Mr. Dawson himself from the creek.
Yeah, he crawled out of the creek, came over to see us, and was like, I'm gonna play.
He fell out of the castle in the sky into the creek, and then when he was wet in the creek, he walked over to the...
To Rachel Dawes?
To the bee in apartment 23.
Is she in that?
James Vanderbeek is in that.
But is Kristen...
Yep. Kristen Ritter is in that,
Ritter?
Yeah.
I was going to call her Kristen Bell, but that's a different
person. Fun fact, I'm going to completely... James Vanderbeek plays a version of himself in The Bee in Apartment 23.
Cool.
It is James Vanderbeek as James Vanderbeek. Yep.
He also kisses Ian Somerhalder from Jason's favorite series, Lost, in a very bad movie.
All right, that's good.
Oh.
Anyway.
Hayao Miyazaki is like cursing us right now.
Let's move into the meet cute. What's that, Jason?
The meet cute is a term we stole from romantic comedies where we tell everybody where we first meted or cuted this said media. Wendy, when was the first time you watched Castle in the Sky?
I was pretty young. I was still living in Taiwan, so this was pre-1992 when I saw it, I want to say.
Oh, wow. All right.
Did you watch it in English or in Japanese?
I watched it in Japanese because back then, I don't even remember. I think it was one of those... We were at my grandfather's friend's house, and they had one of those, like, fancy, like, laser disc player.
Uh-huh.
but it wasn't, like, DVD size. It was, like, large.
Oh, yeah.
They record size.
Yeah, they were record size, yeah.
Yeah, it was one of those, you know, pulled it out, like, we're going to watch Castle in the Sky. And I want to say, and I don't know this because I was too young, but I want to say the only option they had were Japanese original audio with Chinese subtitle on the bottom.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Now, have you seen the English dub as well?
I actually did. The last time I saw this movie, which is a couple of years ago when I showed it to Dustin, we watched it in the English dub. And then when I rewatched it in prior to this podcast, I did kind of, it was weird. I did half in English dub and then second half in the original Japanese audio.
Can I ask? Wendy's had the full cultural experience. Yeah.
So I was going to ask then, in terms of the cast, like, who do you think is the better Patsu and who do you think is the better Shida of between the English dub and the Japanese dub?
Japanese Pazu takes the cake for me.
Oh, okay.
Dawson's Creek. He was good. But Japanese Pazu was better. For Shita, I actually enjoyed both. I enjoyed both of their iteration of it. I think for me, though, just to hear the original Japanese audio, sometimes certain emotions come across better for me. And that's why I try to watch it. But the reason I did both was because I was trying to handle something as I was watching the first part of the movie. Yep. And I was like, I can't multitask if I do the Japanese audio. I can't read subtitles and do something else.
That's why I did both. A very real thing where you're like, do I have the time or the resources to read this movie? And that's... Subs and dubs rate is like a huge thing, and particularly in anime, people love to fight about it, but we very much are like, whatever works for you is great.
You know, looking at the cast of this movie right now, I did not realize that in the English dub, Mandy Patinkin, Twitter's favorite grandpa, is in this cast.
As who?
He's Lewis, apparently.
Che Guevara himself.
Yeah. Did not know that.
Twitter's favorite grandpa. Yeah. Wow.
Ashley, I believe you already said this. Your meet and cute was when we watched it last week, right?
Yes, this was the first time I had ever watched Castle in the Sky, but I do know this is a favorite of Emmanuel Chateauneuf, who is my artist on Aurora in the Eagle. So I was really excited because I've seen a lot of stills and a lot of short essays on it on her social media. So I was very hyped. But yeah, last week was the first time I watched it.
Yeah, same here. I weirdly thought I had saw this one before, and I had not, so I was very surprised by this. Also, speaking of surprises, don't forget that you can support this podcast over at patreon.com/Jawin, J-A-W-I-I-N. That's where we're going to kidnap Wendy. We're not going to let her leave this recording. And we're going to talk about pop culture, what she's enjoying in terms of TV, movies, and books. And so if you want to hear that conversation, support the podcast and come over to patreon.com/Jawin. All right, Ashley, let's get into the main discussion where we're going to talk about some Castle in the Sky because that's what the people demand.
Yes, exactly. So the full title of this movie is actually Laputa: Castle in the Sky, but it was shortened to Castle in the Sky in the English dub and I think has pervaded pop culture in this way. It first premiered in Japan in 1986. Miyazaki was considered a lesser known director at this time. Nausicaa had come out, Nausicaa in the Valley of the Wind, but technically the first Studio Ghibli movie was Kiki's Delivery Service, which we talked about. And it only made 1.16 billion yen at the box office, which was the lowest Ghibli movie at the time. And it's funny that it comes so close to Kiki because when the movie starts and we open with Shida and the whole beautiful sequence of her floating down from the sky, the whole time I was like, she just looks like Kiki. Like the character design is so very, very similar to that.
The poster of this movie that is on Wikipedia is that scene of her floating and Patsu looking at her. It's a beautiful poster. But when this movie opened up and it was like the military blimp and all the, you know, and Cloris Leachman's character coming after them, I honestly was like, this is more like Gangsters in the Sky. Like, we have flying people with Gatling guns.
Everyone in this movie who is not the two child leads is very... big boned, like they all look like they're these huge Nordic people. All the ladies are very well endowed, and all the men have huge heads, which is it's both typical and atypical of a Miyazaki movie. Like I think of Spirited Away, and I think of Baba Yaga, and she's obviously like cartoonishly large by comparison to like some of the more delicate looking spirits. But because they're sort of all living in that same universe, I'm like, I guess the Laputians are if this were live action, they would be played by the Japanese actors, and I guess everybody else would be played by like some nice Germans or Swedes or something like that. But the beginning of the movie is very, I would say, silly compared to a lot of other Studio Ghibli movies, because the Sky Pirates come in heavy with a lot of comedy, which I think is why Cloris Leachman was obviously chosen for the English dub.
And I have a theory about this, and Wendy, I would love to hear your thoughts on this. Wendy, are you a fan of Futurama?
I've watched a couple of episodes and I enjoyed them. I wouldn't call myself like diehard, hardcore fan.
That's fine.
Wendy, we sit in a room with Futurama action figures. No, it's fine.
I understand this.
anyways, there is a character on Futurama that is called Mom, who is very, has a very big bosom. And is very controlling, very loud, and she has three idiot sons that follow her around. And as soon as I saw this, my mind immediately went to, I guarantee Matt Groening ripped this movie off for Mom in Futurama. Because that's immediately, because they're constantly, like most of the movie, those guys act like the dunderheads in Futurama, where they're always like, Mom, what are you doing, Mom? I guarantee you that is ripped off from this movie.
How funny.
It also, they spend probably the first 15 minutes like actively trying to murder Sheeta as she's just trying to not die. Like they chase her through the blimp. She falls from the blimp. We get the magic crystal necklace. They chase her through the town that Patsu is from. And a lot of Miyazaki movies do start this way where it's like these adults are actively trying to murder children. And you just sort of have to live in that space and be like, this is fine. Everything's fine.
You know, but I will say this. I understand the idea that Miyazaki was like, we're going to start this movie off with a blast. We're going to start this movie off with a battle, exciting stuff like that. But for me, and Wendy, I'd love to hear your opinion on this as well. I feel the movie doesn't really begin until Sheeta like does the floating.
I agree with that.
And I almost think that you could have almost started the movie there.
I think they're trying to introduce Mark Hamill's character, who is, they sort of red herring who the villain is, because you think it's going to be the Sky Pirates.
Yeah, you think it's going to be Dola.
Yes, but then Mark Hamill comes in doing very much proto Joker, because this is right before Batman the Animated Series, and he stepped into maybe his second most iconic role. You see him as evil white guy businessman for the opening sequence, and then through the course of this, he kind of steps forward and becomes a greater villain. Once we fall from the sky and nobody actually dies, because this is a kids' movie, we meet Patsu, who is this sweet boy working in a coal mine, so he's probably only going to live to be like 25 if he's lucky. I bet he's got that good black lung
He's got the black lung.
And him and Sheeta have several different instances. First, he catches her where she's floating down from the sky. Later on, they float together and hold hands in order to escape from their pursuers. And every time they did that, it reminded me of Chihiro and Haku in Spirited Away, where they're falling from the sky. Aww. And she remembers that he's the spirit of the Kohaku River, and they're like crying together. So it's funny to watch some of these earlier movies and see where Miyazaki's referencing himself in other instances.
Wendy, what do you think about the relationship between Sheeta and Pazu? Like, because I think Miyazaki does a really good job of you see them immediately as romantic leads, even though they're kids.
So they never kiss.
They never kiss, but I think it's there.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, I actually made a note about this when I was watching it last night. And I said, after all the events in the first, 10 minutes of what we see Sheeta go through, you know, before the necklace kind of like slow falls her back down to Earth, I thought it was kind of funny, you know, with having these like military men after her, the Dola gang after her. She wakes up and after, you know, Pazu caught her, and she just trusts him so quickly after being kidnapped. I found that a little jarring, where there wasn't like any sort of explanation, and he was so high energy that maybe she didn't have time to react. But I found that really interesting. Or perhaps when they saw each other, they kind of went, there's a connection there. There's something there. We don't know what it is. But there definitely is like an underline of romance. And yes, they're very young. They're kids. So I didn't need to see them, you know, kiss or anything like that. But the fact that they would risk their lives for each other throughout the story definitely shows that strong connection and chemistry, too. Well,
yeah, it reminded me, and it's interesting, I hadn't thought about the idea that she trusts him very quickly, and I guess I just put that to the nature of...
Kids movie.
Well, I also, to a Studio Ghibli movie, I just kind of like, oh, you're kind of in like this sort of fairy tale land, so I will take bigger leaps. Mm-hmm. But I made this point to Ashley off the air, actually, where, you know, we see so many action movies nowadays where the beginning of the movie, the male lead and the female lead, or the male, whatever, who the two romantic leads are, mm-hmm. they'll start out the first act and they'll be like, oh, F you. Ah, I hope your mother dies. And then before the big climax, an hour and a half later, they will be like, I love you. And you're like, you didn't set any of that up. But I think Miyazaki sets up Pazu and Shida so well. I buy it 100%.
I think we're supposed to hand wave away because the first time they meet, he saves her.
Yes.
And then at no other point, like a lot of Ghibli characters specifically, they're sort of simplified in that like liars lie and good people don't lie.
By the way, I guess we should have pointed out for the listeners, I don't think we did this at this point, that there will be full spoilers for Castle in the Sky.
35-year-old
movie. That came out in 1986. So just FYI, if we're at this point, we're probably going to spoil the end of the movie. You should probably go watch
it. She's a princess. This ties into Gulliver's Travels. What?
Mark Hamill's the villain. It's on HBO Max. We're not sponsored by HBO Max, although I wish we were.
I do too. But just to like wrap up the discussion about romantic leads, it's very famous, a very, very well-known story that Hayao Miyazaki wanted to work for Disney. They said, you're not good enough. And then they shipped him back and he was like, instead of being bitter, he was like, well, I'll just start my own studio and do what you do better. And now Disney distributes his films.
And you're going to buy my movies anyway.
Exactly. which is why I think, one, the animation style doesn't necessarily look as traditionally anime as a lot of its contemporary things at the time, because there is that Disney influence. But I would say Shida and Pazu are, I don't know, 10, 11, maybe. So The comparison that I want to draw between a Disney contemporary would be Snow White, which obviously was made decades before, but Snow White is supposed to be 13. So like, even if you look at like Shida's body and her figure and how buxom she is or is not, versus Snow White looks like a full fledged woman who is ready to get married and have a real sexy time. And she kisses the prince at the end. Like just the way that both of the studios handle their romantic plots and subplots and their treatments of these characters who are children, I think is interesting, because I think Miyazaki consistently illustrates that, and look, he's an old man now, and still making movies, that he understands what it was like to be a young child with a crush better than some Disney studio execs. And I say this as someone who loves The Little Mermaid and really loves that they get together at the end. I noticed that in this, I was like, wow, they're so, so sweet and innocent together. And that's what I think sets something like Castle in the Sky apart. And then also the, I would say the incredibly slow pacing of the movie. And I would love if maybe Jason would speak on this more as I think the most writerly among us. Did you find Castle in the Sky slow?
Yes, I did. But only for the second act. I thought the first act was paced really well. And I thought the last act was paced really well. But the middle act, and as they say, when writing many things, the second act is always the toughest act, right? Because it's the act, you know, they do it here. They start off with a big battle. We get the mystery of the floating, you know, we're kind of floating down. And then the middle is like, okay, we're chased by some bad guys. We're going to the cave over here. I guess we're going over here. We don't know. Oh, we found the castle, you know, like that. And now we're in the last act. But it's always that middle part. I think my biggest problem with the pacing is that I feel that right from the beginning, I mean, it's in the title, Castle in the Sky. It feels like, okay, we're looking for the castle in the sky. And I feel in the second act, we kind of lose that. And you kind of even get the impression that when Pazu and Shida, and this is skipping way ahead, but it's fine, where they decide to join up with the pirates, with Dola and stuff like that, you kind of get the impression that when they do that they just... they've given up. They're like, well, we're never going to find this castle in the sky. So let's just be pirates. And I think that's, I almost think that it would be a slight shift of just perspective, where if there was just an added line where like they're joining the pirates to find the castle, or the pirates have a clue or something of that nature. But it really does feel like they give up the search. And I think that's what drags the movie down, or like makes the movie slow.
Mm-hmm. I think the second act, they deal so much with the mysticism of the crystals, and crystals are such a huge part of 80s storytelling, like the dark crystal obviously all turns around that. And I think we're all more interested in Laputa and the idea of like the castle in the sky. Wendy, did you know that Laputa is from Gulliver's Travels?
What?
Laputian.
No.
It's a Laputian.
Yeah. So
wow.
Lilliput is like the island that he falls into with all the tiny people.
The little right? people.
And Laputa is this like mystical castle kingdom in the sky. So even though this is an original story, it is still referencing like a classic work. And
I love that.
I didn't know that until we did some research for the episode, and I was like, oh wow, I wonder if we should have leaned on that more. I'm not certain.
Gulliver's Travels is a great book, I will say that. And because of that, I am going to call this a Miyazaki adaptation.
It's not. It's original. He wrote it.
Wendy, how do you feel about the pacing of Castle in the Sky? Do you have the same issues that we do?
Like you, I think the second act was kind of, I felt like they lost focus of what it was. All of a sudden it became, you know, less about finding that castle in the sky. And it was just a lot of like chasey bad guys and then underground conversation, which I understand the purpose of that whole conversation with Uncle Palm. But it definitely, like, if I wasn't trying to really take in the movie, I may have like skipped forward just a little bit, having seen the movie, you know, especially before. But I guess it was kind of important conversation to have, because then it wasn't, I think for Pazu and Shita, then it wasn't just like only his father was the person who had come across it once, because now the uncle also confirmed that he's heard tales of it and he knows about the crystal. And, you know, when Shita had it, the crystal out and activated, and he was like, can you put that away? It's a little too strong for me. I'm like, what does that mean? It's too strong for you. And a little warning about, you know, always coming down, because the crystal comes from the earth. So don't forget that you come from the earth and we return to the earth. So I thought that was interesting, but it did drag down the very exciting, you know, start like sky chase and all of that in the first act, where I was just like, okay.
You know, it's interesting. You bring up the idea of Uncle Palm, and I think like right after Uncle Palm is like kind of where the pacing stops.
Yes.
Because I really love the Uncle Palm.
There's always a weird old guy in a Ghibli movie. Well, there's always a weird old guy.
Well, I wrote down, he says this line where he goes, that sounds absolutely splendid. And I'm like, that's a great line. And then the sparkling rock scene where they bring out the thing and all the rocks. And I love it just because it's this amazing metaphor of mankind. And it's like, you know, he's like, they used to mine Ethereum and we don't anymore.
Great fake mineral name, Ethereum.
Yeah, yeah. It's very, yeah. It doesn't sound ridiculous, like unobtainium. Anyways, so.
We love to dunk on unobtainium.
I just think it's such a dumb name.
It is, it is.
And I just love the metaphor of this idea that it's very similar to how mankind used to have this connection to the earth, and now we're with machines and like,
which is what you love about Howl's Moving Castle.
Yes.
Is the sort of environmentalism overtones.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There is a very big environmental, like it's weird because Laputa like very much seems like, oh, this is the way we should be.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, at the end of the movie, when we get there, oh, we're not good enough to live there.
To live with the robots.
So it's going to leave us by. Oh, by the way, we should talk about the robots' greatest characters in this movie, or as I like to call them, the Stone Sentinels.
So I have a little Easter egg actually about these robots. They are not, they have existed in a previous Miyazaki project. So he adapted, he has a series called Lupin the Third, which is like a TV show and movie series, which is based on the Arsène Lupin series of books, which inspired the Lupin show on Netflix. And the long-armed robots first appear in Lupin the Third, and then they just ported the designs over here. And then the tiny little fox squirrels that are running all around them in Laputa debuted in Nausicaa, the Valley of the Wind, which was Hayao Miyazaki's like first big project. So they're both Easter eggs. Yes.
So you're just giving more information that Castle in the Sky is definitely adaptation.
Oh my God. Get out.
Wendy, did anything stand out to you in the middle of the movie, like right before they got to the couch? Like, what were some moments?
Yeah, it's
got to
be all lappy to talk after this.
Yeah.
I honestly, kind of thinking back to it, I don't mind kind of, I call it the calm before the storm.
A literal storm
where I think you really get a sense of Shita and Pazu and kind of see how they react to the current situation, because they're let's not forget that they are kids and they've been both thrown into this situation. You know, either one of them asked for this. I also liked, and I want to say this was in the second act as well. I can't remember because now the movie's kind of like a swirl of stuff in my head, but I think we got to see a little bit of Shita's background where she talked about her parents.
Mm-hmm. And we learned that they're both orphans. Yeah.
I liked the ghost dad moment where Pazu sees his dad. I thought that was really great.
Yeah, I thought that was really great too. So I enjoyed those little moments. And for me, in hindsight, it's kind of a buildup to the big, very fast paced, lots of stuff happening, explosions everywhere, sort of third act.
Well, before we get to Laputa, we got to talk about what might be the greatest scene in the entire movie, just from a character basis, is the scene of... So
I'm trying to think of what you're going to bring up.
You want to make a prediction? I'm happy for both of you to make a prediction. I think is the greatest scene in this movie? Now, this is slightly a joke, but I do think the writing in this scene
is so amazing. That's why I'm not sure, because like, in my opinion, you have to talk about when they're on watch together.
That is a great scene, but that is not.
And everyone's calling each other, but that's not funny.
Yeah. So. No, this is, I think, the funniest moment in the movie. And also, I think... the characterization of all these people are so genius that it is laugh out loud.
I don't know.
Wendy,
the funny scene.
Yeah, this is what I think is the funniest scene in the movie, and possibly also the best written scene in the entire movie.
Maybe when the pirates are trying to, the boys are trying to get on Shita's good side because she's the one that can cook, and they're all being found out that they're all individually have gone into the kitchen secretly and took a chore and a task. And when Louis finds out, he's like, well, you're here already. And they were all kind of trying to get on her good side to get the good food.
Well done. Yes, that is exactly it. I think that...
Also, Miyazaki, another classic, beautiful food sequence.
Yep. Yes. The act that all these brothers is so...
grown adults.
Yep, is so sitcom, yet... so absolutely real. Those brothers would totally do that. It brings in a lot of questions about how old she is, but like the fact that all of them like used excuses to be like, I'm gonna go to the kitchen. and then they're all mad at each other because they all had the same idea.
I wanted to be first.
Yeah. What? You're here? I think that is the funniest scene in the entire movie. And I just think it's so human. Mm-hmm. It's so very human. And like that's the strength of Miyazaki too, is that I think like in a bigger Disney movie, they would have cut that scene. And Miyazaki is like, yeah, it's a little goofy, but I'm going to put it in there.
He also, I think, does a really good job he takes very humble characters or characters who you might consider very dumb. Mm-hmm. And they always have hearts of gold, or they always mean well. Like these characters who we're now laughing about this scene, like that she is actively bonding with, we're trying to murder her in the beginning of the sequence, but because they can see past that, and because the boys,
and they're not malicious either.
They're not. And because the boys are innocent and Shita and Pazu are innocent, they can just let go of what happened before to serve the greater good, which is going to Laputa and then ultimately like reinstilling the monarchy for a glorious future. Yeah.
But also to your point, Ashley, yes, I do think the Shita and Pazu in the I don't know what would you call it, the watchtower.
The crow's nest.
Yeah,
the crow's nest.
And Dola can hear them. Mm-hmm. I think that as well is a pretty great scene.
I love that scene.
I thought the lightning storm that followed this was the most beautiful part of the movie. I know Jason does not agree with me on that, but I also think the crashing sequence, which is sort of the last big crash that we have up to this point, I think it's really, really lovely, and it's a great cue that, like, all right, stuff is like picking back up. Stuff's finally going to happen. And then we just get to enjoy the weird, strange beauty of Laputa for the rest of the film going forward.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean,
can I also add that?
Oh, please do.
We remember like an additional character that we got to meet while we were on the pirate boat. is like kind of the other male character. I guess it's Dad. Did either one of you get the sense that he looked kind of like a version of Dr. Robotnik from Sonic the Hedgehog?
Oh, yes. Okay, so I was 100% about that too. I said that to Ashley
I was like,
I think Sega stole this design because also he looks like the engineer from Spirited Away.
The steam worker, the
spidery guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, like, Miyazaki loves, like, weird dudes with big mustaches and goggles, steampunk goggles.
He loves weird old dudes. Yeah.
No, I thought that, too. I also thought that because if you look at the bikes that Mom and the gang, or Dola and the gang use,
they're called
buzzer bikes.
They also have those flying machines.
Mm-hmm.
And the flying machines are called flapters or flopters. I can't quite remember. Somebody made one and it actually flies.
Oh, wow.
I have a link to the YouTube video. I'll share it. But like, so apparently those are aerodynamically sound.
Wow.
Those are actual flying machines that do work.
They look like dragonflies.
They do. Exactly. All right. We have to talk about the end of this movie because in my opinion, this is the best part of the movie is everything from Laputa forward. I know we had to collect everybody to get them there, but there's also the part of me that's like very American and watching this in 2021 is like, we should just drop them right onto here and just like go from this point forward because we have nothing but drama.
We got to talk about all the robots.
Yes. So right before drama, Shida and Patsu get separated from Dola and the Sky Pirates and we get the sequence with the several many robots. There's not just one long-armed robot with all of the foxes. We get to see the natural splendor of Laputa. And it's interesting because I described a lot of the characters in here as sort of pseudo-Nordic, but it looks like Yggdrasil. It looks like the Tree of Life from Nordic mythology.
Yeah, it's a big garden.
Which this castle has grown up around, which I think all of us would more than happily live on. And in a lot of ways, it'd be
too expensive on Zillow. I just know that.
It depends on which country it is floating above.
That's fair.
But in a lot of ways, like it holds up everything that is bright and beautiful about that part of the world. So what did we all think about finally getting to see Laputa?
Wendy?
I loved kind of going back to what Ashley was saying earlier, the storm and the lightning that kind of built their gateway to get there. And I loved how the lightning sort of lined up as like a runway for their little aircraft to crash land very hard on the castle. But I love that it was once they're on there, it was very serene. It was almost kind of like Naboo feel. You know, beautiful garden, the flowers, and I love the little robot came and it wasn't sort of a get off my island or I'm going to come and take you to the castle, but it was your aircraft is on a bird's nest. Can you please remove that?
Mm-hmm. I love that moment where it's like it was more interested in the bird's eggs than it was in them.
Exactly.
And then I loved the shock turn where they got to the other robot and they're like, oh my God, that's not our robot. That's a dead robot. The design of the robots was great.
Yeah.
And again, I love the idea that this imaginary castle in the sky, the title, we're expecting it to be full of technology and alien and futuristic.
And lived in.
And there's nobody there. And it's like, it's a paradise kind of Eden garden. It's a Garden of Eden kind of a thing.
It's like a bastion of a fallen time almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like that.
And then after we get sort of the end of their love story in a lot of ways, we get adult human beings shooting at children. Patsu gets shot in the face.
In the face. It was kind of scary.
Face. This actual child. And this is where I think the love story is really cemented because both Patsu and Shida at many points as they are struggling, and they wind up kind of in a Raya and the Last Dragon type sequence, going inside the sanctuary and learning that she's the princess, and Mark Hamill's character is like probably a prince.
I still can't believe that Potsy didn't fall to his death. I mean, all those times he was hanging off of
got such a strong grip.
He's been doing chin-ups.
I mean, his grip strength, which by the way is very important for your overall health, is insane. He is like a spider monkey.
These sequences, too, where they get separated and then he's trying to get back to Sheeta to rescue her, even though we wind up learning that she doesn't need being rescued because this is a Studio Ghibli and the girls always make it out okay, was when I really came to appreciate James Vanderbeek's acting in the English dub. I think he did a really, really commendable job for an actor that I have had no opinion on ever. I thought he was really good in these sequences as his character's fighting for his life at the end of the movie.
You should visit him at the creek sometime.
He probably lives in the valley or in the hills somewhere. We could probably get to him.
I mean, yeah, I'm talking about his creek, the Dawson's
Creek.
Yeah. Wendy, what did you think about the climax of the movie, basically all on Lapidus? And it's funny.
It sounded like you said Lapidus. It was really funny.
Look, I'm trying to be very careful with some of these names because this is the one where I find this is the one with the hardest for me to pronounce names. Weirdly,
it's fine. It's not a judgment.
They're just difficult for my middle America tongue. But Wendy, I actually thought there was a chance. I thought they were going to kill Patsu and Sheeta. Mm-hmm. I honestly thought this one was going to be the Miyazaki where they killed the lead. So what did you think about the climax, Wendy?
I love the buildup of it because it just painted that this guy, we kind of knew from the beginning for Muska that it wasn't the treasure, that's what the government was on, but he wanted the big thing. He wants the throne, and
he's Elon Musk, man. Like he wants the power
and to go to space.
He's going to send a car into space had he survived and using this tech. And you just see how destructive he was, you know, kind of building up to that giant as things escalate, you know, once it starts to unravel very quickly once you realize his true motive and his little book, and he knows how to use the necklace. He knows the tech more so than Sheeta because she's so much younger. And then the unveil of that, his last name is also Laputa, when he talked about the family and the people, there are two branches. And I remember as a child watching, didn't really make sense to me. I was like, okay, so what? He's a bad guy. Get rid of him. Mm-hmm. And then grown up Wendy watching this, you know, later on, I was like, oh, it's that one jerk character that was kind of like, but I want the throne. And then they grew up to become this entitled kind of an evil guy. There was a lot happening. I really thought that they were maybe not kill Sheeta, but I thought Pazu's life was very much in danger because he was, to them, he was expendable.
I was truly, there's a couple times where I thought he was going to jump off various cliffs, but I was waiting for him to be flung over the side and to never see him again.
I there was a couple of times where I thought they were going to do an inverse at the beginning where he was going to fall and the floating was going to have to save him.
Mm-hmm. Yes, oh. Jason kept saying like, just give him the crystal, he'll be fine. And I was like, but he's not.
Yeah,
like, doesn't have the special midichlorians.
I know, but I thought that there was going to be some sort of thing where it's like, well, because of your love or whatever, she was going to throw him the crystal and was going to work and
now
save
he's
him.
Aladdin, he's a street rat.
By the way, I want to talk about a funny moment that really made me laugh is, you know, after Laputa goes to space and is like, peace out, we're going
it's
to
cool,
Mars.
Man. It's cool.
It is really cool.
It's 80s as hell anime.
Oh, I love
there.
It. I love it. But then they go back down to the pirates, and I love the moment where the pirates and Dola are like, hey, we robbed your home city.
Look at all this.
Yeah, and she is like, okay, cool. You took my family's jewels.
She has every jewel in between her bosoms.
Yep.
But amazing.
That was like the one moment where I was like, I don't know if Sheeta would be okay. You guys basically robbed her bedroom.
Pretty much. And did you guys think about, as Laputa, the tech part of it was kind of, you know, falling off. Were you guys thinking of the consequences of all those debris falling onto Earth?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, well, Patsu...
You gotta be like, oh, I guess they fell into the ocean.
Well Patsu... when Patsu and Cheetah were doing all the railroad chases, they literally destroyed the entire infrastructure of an entire city. The railroads fall over.
tiny little pseudo-Swiss town.
Yeah, so at this point, I don't think they care about these giant rocks of rubble that are gonna crush.
Or you have to hope that they're high enough into, like, I don't know, which layer of the atmosphere.
The heliosphere?
Exactly. Yeah. I have an English degree. Leave me alone. That it just becomes space junk, I guess.
I don't know if they were that high enough because everybody could breathe. So
yeah, but
that's true.
You know.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there were some farmers that had some problems that day.
Like those poor cows.
Yeah.
All the robots falling onto the earth.
Although the robots, I think, probably survived.
They can fly. Dope if one of those robots lived in your backyard. I would be so happy.
I think there might be a sequel here. Called Robot on the Ground.
Robot Island.
Where a robot wakes up and becomes the best goat farmer in the local city.
You know, I know you're making a joke, but that would be an amazing Studio Ghibli movie.
I was making a joke, but I was also making a very serious pitch for a sequel to this movie.
All right, so if Studio Ghibli's listening and they would like to hire their first American writer, Jason is game.
I will co-write. No, I'll tell you what. I'll just take story credit.
There
I will. Hayo.
There it is.
Hayo, I know you're listening. Just let me write the outline with you. I don't even need to write the script. You do your magic. Let's do it.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, we've reached the end of the movie.
Adult Cheetah and adult Patsu. Yeah.
And then the farmer is the old man with goggles, some old man with goggles that he loves to write.
Adult
so
Cheetah as voiced by Wendy.
Yep. Robot on the ground. I think you did it.
So I got to ask, we start with the big question as we finish talking about the movie. And we'll probably toss this to Wendy first because she's our guest, unless she'd like to pass. What do you think is the legacy of Castle in the Sky, and does it hold up by modern contemporary standards?
I actually think it does. I've seen this movie, I think, a total of 4 times in my life so far. And as a child, and I think this is why it wasn't the first Studio Ghibli film that my grandfather showed me, because the theming is, while it is centered around 2 kids, it is a little bit more adult for me. Like, I remember growing up, one of the iconic scenes that always stuck to my mind was when Muska had the gun pointed at Cheetah and he shoots her braids.
It's horrifying. Off. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's always stuck to me. And now as an adult watching, I really feel that even though the animation is older and everything, I really feel that it holds up, especially with the theming and overall, you know, they're not modern tech. And they acknowledge that in the film For the People on Earth, where, you know, the militia first shows up to look for Cheetah, where Patsu was. And he was like, oh, wow, a real automobile.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very much a period piece, which totally works for till the end of time, I think.
Jason, legacy, does it hold up?
I think this movie is very responsible for Miyazaki's career. Because
interesting.
This is, because you can see where he's going. Mm-hmm. You can see how Howl's Moving Castle comes from this. You can see how Spirited Away comes from this. You can basically see, you can even see where Kiki comes from this.
Well, Kiki was before.
Is Kiki before this?
Yeah.
I think Kiki was after this. Anyways.
Oh, well, I might be mistaken.
Kiki is 89 and this is 86.
Oh, then you're right.
Oh, this is first.
So this is pre-Kiki. I see where Kiki, like, it's interesting because I think this is the one where he goes, like, he's a little crazy in this one. He's really, it's kind of all over the place. But I do think it holds up too. I think it has a heart to it that I think some of his other works don't have. And I'm going to credit that to the adaptation.
You're going to die on that hill.
It has some pacing issues, but I will say that what film pre the 2000 multi, like we're going to have 14 shots across 30 seconds editing style doesn't feel a little slow. But beyond that, I mean, I think the legacy is this, that I think this is the movie that Miyazaki was like, I'm going to try some stuff. There are flying pirates. There are weird robots. And I'm going to see how far I can push it. And I think because this one works and because this one was well received, it led to his later career. What do you think, Ashley?
I think you both nailed it. The legacy is everything that has come since. It does hold up. I do think, to Wendy's point, I do think it's a little more mature. Like, if I were thinking about giving this to a child to watch, I would I would consider who the child is and what their mature versus, like, I give Kiki to any child.
Kiki skews definitely younger. 100%.
I think Princess Mononoke is very similar. Princess Mononoke is awesome, but it is like,
it's an older
it's
movie.
Vicious.
Yeah.
And it's probably the most violent. So for that, I think you both nailed it. Next question is, who is the best character and who is the best actor? They're not always the same answer. Wendy?
Who is the best character?
Or your favorite. Like, best can mean however you'd like to interpret it.
I have two answers. And it's surprisingly not the, it's not
the same,
the protagonist.
Oh, okay.
I would say my favorite is actually Mom of the Dola Gang.
Hell yeah.
I think she's amazing. You go see her from, you know, this, like, I just want the crystal to get the jewels, which she still through and through gets to the end. But you do see a softer side of her. And she truly does care for, you know, the well-being of Patsu and Shita while still, you know, running a very tight ship with all her pirate boys.
Literally.
And then, yeah, really, literally. And then the other, like, best actor, mm-hmm. I gotta give it to Muska, because the level of, like, pure evil and selfishness.
Fair.
Through and through. And also, if they ever made this into a live action adaptation, but also please don't. But if they do, Paul Bettany can 100% play Muska.
Ooh, that's a good call. I understand your feeling where you're like, I have the perfect casting choice, but please never adapt any of these.
No, never.
Jason, best actor, best character?
So mine are the same, and I'm going off the US dub. I think Pazu is the best character. Mm-hmm. I think.
So your answers are not the same, because Wendy said Dola was the best character.
Oh, no, I meant mine is the same as the best character.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You misinterpreted, I apologize.
I think James Vanderbeek is, in terms of the US dub, mm-hmm. I think he does a really good job. I don't think he sounds like himself. And also, this would have been a pretty young James. So, mm-hmm. And I actually think he does a better job than some of the other American actors actually matching the lips.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Pazu, we've seen other versions of this same story where that same character is just the very annoying boy.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he's annoying. I think he's very heartfelt here. Mm-hmm. I think he's very straightforward. He's very innocent and he's very heartfelt. And I think a lot of that, I definitely think he's way more interesting than Cheetah. you know, so like, yeah, it is very, you compared to Aladdin earlier and
it is very
similar to Aladdin. So yeah, mine is, you know, Dawson of the Creek, James Vanderbeek and Pazu. Nice. What about you, Ashley?
My answer is kind of equidistant between both of you. I think Pazu is the best character,
mm-hmm.
Which is interesting because I agree with you. Cheetah is maybe the driest of the female leads, at least in the movies that we've seen so far, which is fine. This is early. She's not unlikable or anything like that, but you can tell, like, she is a proto Chihiro or like other characters who are to come in the future. I think the best actress, Cloris Leachman as Dola, like, she's such a gift. She's so funny. And she obviously goes on to influence a lot of other characters, maybe both in and outside of the canon. So the last question that we have for our wrap up is a rating for Castle in the Sky. Our scale is 1 to 5 intern cat Bregos. We do allow half cats. It's your choice, whether
front
it's
half
the front
or
half or the back,
back
half.
Half.
So Wendy, as the guest and our expert, what are you going to rate Castle in the Sky?
I don't feel like I want to do a half because it's cat.
I agree. It's a, oh, it's no. a tough choice to do.
I'll give it a solid 4.
There you go.
No front half or back half. Full whole cats for this film. I think that I just had to knock off 1 point for the kind of slower paced second act. And it was a bit, you know, all over the place, but this is one of his earlier films. So I can understand that he's trying to still, even though I love this animation and the storytelling is incredible, I feel like he was still trying to find his footing when it comes to exact storytelling. But nonetheless, having watched this movie from childhood to adulthood, I would watch this over and over again. So 4 out of 5.
Jason?
I agree. I'm going to give this a 4 out of 5 Bregos. I think for all its faults, the heart is still there. The pieces are still there. The creativity is still there. I mean, I always judge things on how much do I emotionally connect with the characters. Like, how successful does the creator do that? And I really do think he does an amazing job with selling the two leads, and making you love them and feel them. The bigger problems with this movie, I think, are just, I think Hayao, and please forgive me, I know you listen. I think Hayao, I would have loved to have seen this movie 10 years later in his career. Like, I think, like, if he had made this movie in the mid 90s, I think this movie would be a solid five. And a lot of people would be, this is the best one of all of them. I just think he, again, he
this is consistently in people's top 10 when they pull out the whole Studio Ghibli offering.
And you know what? I think it's because of the heart of the characters. Mm-hmm. Like, so you're willing to forgive the rough edges because it's just so good. So I think it's a 4 out of 5.
There you go. I'm going to agree with both of you and go 4 out of 5 Brego. So he makes it through unscathed.
Yay.
For this episode. He's not in this room, so he doesn't care.
Yeah, he's currently not in the recording studio right now. Where is that damn intern?
He is uninvested.
He does not care about the castle in the sky or our new money venture robot on the ground.
A big way that I choose my ratings is if I would watch this again. And if at any point someone said, do you want to watch Castle in the Sky? I would be more than happy.
I'd watch it again.
To
yeah.
watch it again. Mm-hmm. And also, I think if you're in any way tapped into either the anime scene or you're interested in Studio Ghibli or Hayao Miyazaki specifically, the image of her falling and Patsu catching her is iconic. I have seen that image.
It's on the poster.
I've seen it my whole life.
It's great.
Like, I've seen it gift. There are memes. So like, it's also, it's just broken the pop culture sphere in that way.
It's a 4 out of 5 just because of that sequence.
Just because it's iconic. There you go. Yeah. Our recommended viewing and reading this week is the Castle in the Sky Blu-ray because it's based on nothing. So just get that and check it out.
We have Gulliver's Travels.
Sure. We'll put Gulliver's Travels in the recommended.
Go to geekhistorylesson.com/recommended reading and read Gulliver's Travels, the book that Castle in the Sky. Stevenson. I don't think it's Robert Louis Stevenson. Is it? I don't know. I'm going to find out real quick.
I can't tell you the last time I read Gulliver's Travels, man.
High school is when I read it.
Well, Jason,
same for me.
Yeah,
Jonathan Swift.
Oh, wrong.
That's who wrote
completely
Gulliver's
wrong.
Travel.
Let's go into the teaching tweet, Jason. What's that?
The teaching tweet is a section of this podcast that Ashley keeps wanting to add, and you people have voted to keep twice, where we talk about the subject of this podcast in somewhere around 140 characters, maybe more, 280 characters. I don't even know what Twitter does anymore. But you can find this tweet if you follow us over at Twitter at GHL Podcast. Ashley, teaching tweet, go.
Laputa Castle in the Sky. A girl just fell from the sky into Kiki's character design and brought us to the world of Gulliver.
Yay.
Hey, didn't bring us into the world of Gulliver.
Yeah,
by the way, Jonathan Swift wrote a lot of poems. I'm looking at his Wikipedia right now.
Well, he's no Robert Louis Stevenson.
That's true. He is no Robert Louis Stevenson. That is very fair.
I don't even care for Robert Louis Stevenson's work, so
dare
I don't
you.
Know why I got them confused. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is boring.
What's the next
Classics
section of our podcast,
Ashley?
Honor
roll. What's that?
The honor roll is where, listeners, if you go over to Apple Podcasts, no longer iTunes, leave us a 5-star review, we will read your review on the podcast. Doesn't matter what you say. We're going to read it. Ashley, who joins the honor roll?
We have two people joining today. The first is McMa14, who says, I love this podcast so much. I literally found this podcast by accident, and I just can't stop listening. Been listening to the podcast for weeks. I'm obsessed. I would love to hear Emma Frost, Kitty Pryde. We did Kitty Pryde. Or Rogue Lesson. You are amazing. Big hugs. Thank you so, so much. And they are also joined by Ty the Lightning, who says, keep up the good work. I love your podcast so much. You guys help me not only get through the pandemic, but also my job because it is very boring. I also like that you covered some of my favorite heroes like Red Hood and Black Panther, as well as Blue Beetle. Still working my way down the list. I hope to get an episode on DC Vixen. We did one. And maybe Ben Reilly's Spider-Man. We didn't do one if you haven't done them already. So Ty the Lightning and McMa14, welcome into the Teacher's Lounge. Jason, what is going on there this week?
Well, new professor Wendy is in the Teacher's Lounge. Mm-hmm. And Wendy, if you could teach any subject, and I'm
literally any
subject. Literally a subject that does not exist at the Mind University, what would you like to teach?
This is so basic, but it's also so me, and it would be fun. I would teach a Disney bounding 101 fashion geek fashion course.
That's very true.
Wait, when you say Disney bounding, is that what you call that?
Yeah, that's like the classic Disney or a casual Disney fashion.
Oh, I just have never heard that before. Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay.
What, yeah, right, it was cool. By, oh, and I can't remember her name. So I will have to rebuild my syllabus before I come back and actually teach the course. But I did not coin that phrase. It's by Leslie. I can't remember her last name, but she is the woman who coined it. And you just, you know, dress like your character using themes and color blocking and designs, but not wearing an actual costume into a Disney theme park.
Well, there you go. Professor Wendy is going to be a tough but fair professor. And also, Professor Wendy, thank you so much for joining us. Please let our listeners know, because I know you have a podcast. You have all kinds of things you do. Please tell our listeners where they can get more of you, because they should want to listen to more of you.
Oh, thank you so much. You can check in on the Geek and Glitter podcast, where we talk about, well, what do you know, geek fashion and lifestyle, so much more. You can find that anywhere you download podcasts. On YouTube, you can find the Movie Couple channel, where my husband and I, Dustin, sit down and talk about movies, the latest trailers, movie news, pop culture, and so much more. Today, we ate food on our live stream. That's what we did. So if you want to check that out, that's there for you. And streaming on Twitch every now and again, playing some cozy games, twitch.tv/WendyLeeZaney.
Everyone go check that out. And also, if you need more Wendy, don't forget that she's going to join us for a Geek History Lesson Extra over at patreon.com/Jawin. We're going to ask her what she's been watching, what she's been reading, what she's been ingesting. And the answers might surprise you. So go check that out. Don't forget to follow this podcast everywhere on social media. Ashley, where can they find it?
You can do that at geekhistorylesson.com, facebook.com/geekhistorylesson, or on Twitter at GHL Podcast. There's like a billion ways to contact us in all of those places.
And don't forget to follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Jawin. That's J-A-W-I-I-N. Follow Ashley on Instagram and Twitter. She posts way more on Instagram than I do, so you definitely should follow her on Instagram at Ashley V. Robinson. And now we're to the final part of the podcast, hashtag stick around, where we make sure you stuck through all our shameless plugs. Ashley, what are we chatting about today?
Very important question. I know we have all seen several Studio Ghibli Hayao Miyazaki projects. If you could live in any Hayao Miyazaki location,
oh boy,
where would you want to live?
Okay.
I can start if that's please, something that we need to think about.
Please do.
Yes.
I truly, like, sans question, want to live in the bathhouse from Spirited Away. I would be.
Oh my gosh.
But I want to live up in Baba Yaga's, like, nice, really bougie apartments above it. But you could get to hang out with all those spirits. It's very witchy. There's cute little mice who live there. Like, it just seems like a really great time. And if you follow me on Instagram, you know I'm a girl who loves a bath. So if I owned it, I wouldn't have to pay for it. And the food in Spirited Away is next level. Plus, 12-year-old me had a really, like, deep abiding crush on Haku, so I could just, like, hang out with my little boyfriend all the time. So it's
nice.
So it's the perfect place, in my opinion.
Wendy, that. Where would you like to live?
I think I would want, like, that kind of the house that they're in for My Neighbor Totoro.
Ooh,
I think it's serene.
Yes.
It's nice. You get to unplug from all the social medias, because I don't think you're going to be able to get any sort of, like, tower signal out there at all. So it'd be like a nice weekly weekend getaway.
All right, Jason.
I want to live in Howl's Moving Castle, but it's parked like a few feet off the ground, because there's that scene where it's outside the city and it's like rolling green hills.
Yes. Yeah.
So I don't really want the castle to move around. I want it to float.
Jason's parked castle.
Yes, Jason's parked castle a few feet off the ground. That's where I would want to.
Hovering castle?
Yeah, there you go. Hovering castle. Yeah. How's hovering castle? Well, because I want to stay close to the robot on the ground.
There you go.
That's true.
Yep, that's it. Wendy, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Geek History Lesson.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a great, great time. Can I ask the both of you what films from Miyazaki you have not seen yet? Well, not Miyazaki, but Studio Ghibli.
Oh, I have never seen, I would say I've seen less than I have not seen. I haven't seen Nausicaa.
My favorite.
I'm waiting for the anniversary to come around, because we'll probably do.
We're getting there.
Yes. The one I'm trying to get Jason to watch is Grave of the Fireflies, which I don't think is Ghibli technically, but that's like a Miyazaki movie.
Correct.
I haven't
bring
seen
your tissues.
I haven't
get
seen
ready to cry.
Any Lupin the Third, but I'm very interested in that.
I've seen that.
I've seen a lot more of the modern ones, because Spirited Away was the first one that I saw. So after that, it was like watching Forward.
I have not seen Ponyo.
Ponyo's so cute. It's his telling of the Little Mermaid.
Yeah, and I have not seen Porco Rosso. I have not seen that one either.
Excellent.
The one that I think would be hysterical to watch would be Pompoko. So that's about these Japanese spirits and they're raccoons, but they have giant testicles.
They do.
You told me about that.
Yes, yeah, yeah. But it's supposed to be a great movie, and it is a very like culturally Japanese thing, but it was not allowed to be distributed here because they have giant testicles.
Do they sound like gangsters, really? Or they're just like, what are you looking at? Hey.
One of them does, actually.
Yeah. Avert your eyes.
Yeah. One of them literally sounds like that.
My
maybe
eyes are up
them.
Here, chicky.
The other one we were thinking about doing this year, and I gave Jason the choice because we had a conflict about what episode was going to come out, was
a scheduling conflict. Well, we didn't fight over Miyazaki.
No. the biggest fight.
Cool your chats, listeners.
The biggest fight we have is which movie's better. Was from Up on Poppy Hill.
Yes.
Was the other one that we considered.
Which I have not seen that
year.
One either.
I haven't seen it either. Mm-hmm. But I've seen most of the modern ones.
I don't know. Maybe we should just bring Wendy back. Professor Wendy.
For every Miyazaki movie?
Sure. Why not?
I will happily come back for Nausicaa. That is my favorite Miyazaki film. And I feel like it's so underrated because it's one of his first. Yeah, it is an adaptation, so there you go, Jason, of Miyazaki's own manga of the same name.
It's going to be good, though.
And it's like you guys talked about earlier, the environmental nods that Miyazaki's film have. I feel like that one is really, really heavily themed around that.
Well, we had a previous conversation once about like what we would like, is there anything we would love to see Miyazaki adapt? And I said, I was like, I would love to see it, the Miyazaki Wizard of Oz. Because I think he would not.
Ooh.
I think it would be the only. I think he's literally the only creator in the world
who could add something to it.
That could add something to it, or maybe equal the Judy Garland Wizard of Oz, because that's the big thing. That's the big hill that nobody can cross past that movie, because it's so indelible in our pop culture. So there you go. Yeah, he should also do Star Wars. Let's give him a Star Wars.
Yes.
I mean, if you want to get all of my money for a Star Wars thing, yeah.
But you have to let Disney cannot touch him.
We'll see, but that's why it's never.
And that's
happen.
Why it'll never happen. He gets a turn in a finished film.
I will say though, and this will probably date around the time that this episode was recorded, but like the Star Wars anime thing that's coming out,
Visions. I think
I was like, ooh, that seems fun.
Yeah.
That might be cool. Right.
Well, let's save this for the Patreon extra that you guys will have to come over. Patreon.com/Jawlins. Wendy, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me. What a great conversation. I loved it.
Thank you, everybody out there, for listening to this episode of Geek History Lesson. I have been Jason Pazu Forever Inman.
I am Ashley Victoria Robinson.
And Professor Ashley, will you please close out this podcast?
Class is now dismissed.